This is File 34. This is Jane McMillan. I am interviewing Bill Litauer, who is president of the Lake Wenonska Pomic Association. He's going to talk about the Salisbury Forum, the Civic Project, and the Salisbury Dog Park as well. Today's date is July 14th, 2016, and we'll start with the genealogical information. What is your name?
Phil Litauer. Oh,
and your birth date?
It's June 10th, 1939.
Where were you born?
In Portchester, New York.
And your parents' names?
Was Marita Olkers and...
Ooh, maiden name is which?
Olkers, O-E-L-K-E-R-S.
Okay, and your father's name?
Frederick Jerome Litauer.
Nice name. And you have siblings?
Yes. Well, there were four of us. Now there's three left.
And they...
I mean, there were five of us, including myself.
They are or were?
Yeah.
You had a sister?
Right. My oldest sibling is my sister, Marita, named after my mother. Mm-hmm. And then I had three brothers.
You had Stephen.
Stephen.
And who were the other?
He's the youngest. Then Frederick. And Richard.
Alrighty. And your education after high school?
Was Brown University.
And what was your degree?
I didn't get one. I quit after three semesters.
I knew that was coming. I knew that was coming. But it was a sensible thing to do.
Well, it was.
In your circumstances.
In my circumstances, it probably was, because I was passing the so-called gentleman C. I didn't really like it. I was bored to death, except for my participation in the college radio station, which
I
loved.
So you found your niche. You found your niche.
And I loved, certain classes I liked. I liked history. I liked English. You know, if I could write or speak, it was great.
Uh-huh.
If I had to do math or chemistry or anything like that,
no.
I took chemistry 101, and after 6 weeks, the professor told me in the lab, don't bother coming anymore. There's no way you could ever pass this course.
Oh, ouch.
He'll never forget that.
Oh, Lord. Well, the rough end of his tongue, but maybe it worked out.
But he was right, of course. Yes.
Oh, yeah. How did you come to the area?
I came here because one of my close neighbors in Larchmont, New York, just outside the city where we lived, had a house up here, and we came to see him and his wife. And on the way home, we looked at a house and decided to buy it.
Oh, that's nice.
Yes.
That's nice. And you said that you just bought a house in Larchmont.
Only the year before, yeah.
My word. Great property.
But well, the problem was, like many people, you have a family and a big house, and they're all there, and then gradually they all move away and get married or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And you're left with a big house.
Yep.
Which becomes a hotel at Christmas time. Right? So we
said, I hope you charge.
Yeah, yeah, we should have it. But anyway, we bought an apartment in Larchmont.
Mm-hmm.
And then I very quickly discovered I'm not an apartment person. I just was
Nothing to do, exactly.
I was bored stiff. So the house up here was wonderful. We right on a lake. We have, enough grounds to have gardens, and mm-hmm. I could do vegetables and flowers. And
when did you buy the house up here? What year?
In 1999.
Ah, okay. I think I know the answer to the next question, but how did you get involved with the Lakeville Lake Association? The Wenonska Pomic.
Right, the Lake Wenonska Pomic Association. Well, it was easy because we came up here, and the first summer of 1999, we tried to go swimming and got all caught up in the milfoil. And I said, this is ridiculous. So first we tried pulling it ourselves, we had the town harvesters working out in the deeper water. But it was very hard to swim through, and we have a lot of milfoil around our property. So I tried to...
Do something
about it, and that meant getting involved with the Lake Wenonska Pomic Association. And I guess after the first year, I was all of a sudden president. So
yeah, they do that.
Yes.
I was told early on, always show up at meetings because you never know.
That's right.
When was the Lake Wenatskapamic Association actually formed?
It was formed in September of 1988.
And why was it formed?
Well, for that reason, because the milfoil was a huge problem. Now, I should go back. The first major study of the lake was in 1975. It was done by Union Carbide mm-hmm. Corporation, and it was ordered by the town and the Salisbury Association. The reason was that over the years, the lake has undergone an enormous transition, and all of that is due to the watershed. You know that Lakeville was a rural area. We had before the early 1700s, there was just some Indians here primarily. Then we had the iron ore industry develop, and then farming was major. None of that really did any damage to the lake. You might think it did, mm-hmm. but it really didn't. The damage to the lake started at the end of the 19th century and the beginning of the 20th century when railroads brought people here and people could come for extended stays. They built houses, and our watershed started filling up with houses and people living there, and people create waste. And
they certainly
that
do.
Is the problem. So the how the milfoil came to the lake is really not known, but we assume there's only two ways it could have come in, either on somebody's boat or somebody had a aquatic garden. They got bored with it, tossed it out, and just a fragment of milfoil got down to the lake, and it just expands like crazy.
Do you have a mission statement?
Yes, and the mission statement is basically to improve, protect, and maintain the ecological status of the lake.
There was talk of putting sewer around the lake back in 1916. It's never gotten all the way around the lake, but there is sewer someplace.
There is, and that is the one of the major problems. Back in 1975, there was a huge study of where does the phosphorus come from, that major nutrient that feeds the milfoil and also leads to deoxygenation mm-hmm. of the water. If you don't have enough oxygen in the water,
things die.
Things die, but also it rises up, the phosphorus rises up into the water column and feeds the algae, mm-hmm. and you get algae blooms. We have had blue-green algae in this lake.
Oh, yes.
Nowhere near as severely as the recent blooms along the Florida East Coast.
Thank goodness.
Yeah, thank goodness. But that was part of what led to the formation of the Lake Association, because you had these two problems. Algae fed by increasing phosphorus feeding the lake, and milfoil. So, by 1992, the Lake Association, with a large donation from Hotchkiss, purchased a new harvester for the town to use to clear the milfoil in the lake as much as possible.
Does the state regulate you at all, or are you private?
Not really. We're private. The state is interested in the lake because we have a public beach there.
Sure.
And a launch and so forth.
Do you know how deep the lake is?
106 feet at its deepest point.
I was asked by somebody yesterday, and I know who to ask.
Yeah, it's the deepest lake in Connecticut.
Yeah, I knew that, and I knew that it was one of the larger natural lakes,
yeah.
but I didn't know how deep it was.
Okay. Well, of course, it is natural, but assisted by man.
Oh, yeah.
Because
but it isn't something that was dug.
No. There was a lake, and when they dammed it, mm-hmm. first of all, for a grist mill, originally. But then the primary use of it was to work the bellows for the foundry
sure.
at the base of the lake, which is how the lake became known as Furnace Pond.
It isn't.
Originally.
It was Furnace Pond, and this was called Furnace Village.
Furnace Village. And then in the mid-1800s, the townspeople decided that that wasn't a very attractive name, and they came up with Wenonskapamak. How they came up with Wenonskapamak is unknown, really, because it means, in an Indian dialect, local Indian dialect, it means literally the marshy area at the bend. Now, if you're going to name a lake, that wouldn't exactly...
Like Washining and Washini. Laughing Water and Smiling Water. That's better. Yeah. They didn't have a good PR agent.
No, so you can come up with whatever definition you want to put on it, but that is actually where it came from. I looked it up.
Good for you.
Yes.
How do you fund the things that you do?
It's all by contributions from about two-thirds, maybe less than two-thirds even, 60%. Comes from property owners around the lake. Another 5 or 7 or 8% comes from Hotchkiss, and the rest is from other people
that are interested in the lake.
Mostly people who use it through the town grove.
Do you have a board?
Yes.
And how many are on the board?
16 at the moment.
And what's your term of office?
Well, it's really a year, because we don't have a term limit or anything. Mm-hmm. So
you're on it until you want to get
off.
Yeah,
pretty much. Yes,
that seems to be the way it goes. You told me 4 different things about how you spend your money.
Well, the main things we do, of course, is we did participate in the town harvesting project. However. A year ago, in 2015, we bought what's called an eco-harvester. It's a small harvester with a very shallow draft, about 8 inches, actually. And so we can get in much closer to people's beaches and around people's docks to try and get the milfoil away so that you can go swimming right off your area. Mm-hmm.
And you said that cost about $60,000.
It was $60,000 for the machine and trailer.
Okay.
The big harvester that the town bought the same year.
That was $100,000,
wasn't it? $210,000. But of course, with interest rates at 2% or less.
It
was not a bad deal.
It surely wasn't.
It was a good time to buy it and to extend the payments out 10 years. So. That's what the town did. Now, the other things we do, we also put down mats in the swim lanes at the town grove that prevents the milfoil from growing at all. And that's really only, because it's expensive, it's only useful in a small area, like the swim lanes, so that you can have swimming meets and so forth without milfoil being a problem. We also have someone stationed at the grove on Saturday and Sunday mornings when most people come in to fish and launch boats, to check them for anything they might be bringing in, make sure they're dry, essentially.
Yeah, zebra
mussels. We don't want them bringing in zebra mussels or any other invasive species, such as hydrilla or lily ponds and whatnot. And then we do studies on the lake on an annual basis. Last year, we did an intensive year-long study measuring the oxygen and the phosphorus and the nitrogen and the temperatures and so forth, because it all goes back to that 1975 Union Carbide study as to know what's happening to the lake. Is it getting better or worse, and in what way? The idea is to try to catch any deviation, head it off, before it gets to be a problem. And then this year we're doing a mapping of the vegetation in the lake, so we know what weeds are where in the lake, so that if we have any on the state endangered list, we can protect them. If there's any action we might take.
What are some of the invasive weeds that you have besides?
Well, the only one that we have so far is Eurasian water milfoil. That's the major one. We so far have not turned up
anything else.
Anything else? Hopefully, this study that is ongoing at the very moment won't show that we've acquired a new one.
Now, these harvesters, the town has a big one, and you've got this
little one.
Do they cut the weeds, or?
Well, the one we bought is supposed to pull the weeds out by the roots.
Ah.
It does not, however. It does rip them out at the base, kind of. You can go down pretty, you know, I can get the roller down about 4 feet, so we can rip them pretty close. But they do grow back. On the other hand, one of the methods that had been tried in the past was called hydro raking, and that is essentially a small barge with a York rake on it. York rake being just one of those big, super large rakes that...
Okay, like a harrow.
Kind of like a harrow that you can extend down into the water. It rips up the weeds and anything else that's there, and then they dump it on your shore, and you've got to get rid of it.
Called passing the buck.
Well, it's also expensive because it leaves this big mass of mud and weeds and stuff, and for most people it costs as much or more to get rid of this muck than it did to pay the guy who did the hydro raking. And even so, when you did the hydro raking, a month later, the weeds were starting to grow back again. It's like cultivating a garden.
After you've harvested the weeds, what happens to them?
They're taken to the new transfer station site and dumped. Milfoil, when it dries, becomes very light and feathery. So, while it's heavy coming out of the water, once it dries, it takes up very little space, actually.
So it's going to sort of cover the footprint of the new transfer station?
No, I think it's just...
In one area?
It's just in one area. Just kind of like at the current transfer station, there's a site where you can take leaves and they're just composted.
I see.
And that's essentially what will happen here.
In order to get rid of the weeds, do you use any chemicals?
No, we don't. The best way to get rid of the weeds, of course, would be with an agent using 2,4-D. However, 2,4-D raises the specter of Agent Orange.
Yeah.
People get very excited. It's not Agent Orange, and in fact, it's used in Roundup, which many people use on their driveways and so forth. So the other way is with a weed herbicide that suppresses them. Twin Lakes has used this for a number of years successfully. The problem is you have to do it every year. They come back.
Yes, I'm sure.
It suppresses them. It doesn't kill them.
Ted Davis did some studies of the water back in 69.
He did them for at least 20 years. Mm-hmm. And that's a large basis of the information that we have on the lake.
Okay.
In fact, we discovered... We didn't realize it until fairly recently that there are files of his material at the state DEP. But, of course, nobody really has looked at them since got a hold of them. So we are kind of in a long process of trying to put everything together into one data bank.
So that would make sense, because then you would have past history right up through.
That's right.
It's what I'm trying to do.
Yeah, exactly. It's if you don't know what you've got, you can't analyze it, and you can't project what's going
to
happen.
Yeah, you really have to have the backstory in order to move forward.
Exactly.
And I gather that you are the proprietor of running the eco harvester because
I got stuck with it last summer. This summer, the Interlaken Inn has provided someone to run it one day a week.
Oh, good.
So, everybody agreed that probably the person running a machine like that should be younger than 77.
Oh, but you've got experience and
but
knowledge.
I do have the experience now.
Oh, yeah.
And it is very useful because on a machine like that, to know where it has to be lubricated. There are 31 lubrication points that have to be done every time you use it.
You've moved to emeritus.
That's it.
Oh, good. And you do share your information with the Twin Lakes Association.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. But first of all, they're on our mailing list, so that they get every email I send out, they get a copy of. They come to our meetings, and we trade information, of course.
And who is the president of that association?
Twin Lakes is Carrie Firtz.
And that's F-I-E-R-T-Z. And your communication, you have a website?
Oh, yes. It's lakewenanskapamic.org.
And you do brochures and pamphlets?
We do. We have a very nice pamphlet that one of our board members, Mary Silks, prepared, which we send to all new property owners in the watershed, and which we can distribute, you know, at the town grove or at mm-hmm. events. Mm-hmm. We do some educational production, and it just talks about good lake management, how to make sure that you're not pouring phosphorus down into the lake out of a septic system or out of what kind of dishwasher material mm-hmm. you use and so forth.
Would there be with P&Z regulations as to how far from the shore your septic system has to be?
Actually, that's a state health department regulation. And the P&Z regulations are that you have to be 75 feet from a water course, whether it's a lake or a stream whatever.
Any
kind of body of water.
Okay. Who were the early founders?
I have to just quickly
That's fine.
Look up. Because I wasn't here, obviously. But
you gave me Ann Cuddy.
Yes.
Judy Gott.
Yep.
Rod Aller.
Yep.
Bob Black.
Yep.
Graham Davidson. Peggy Heck. Debbie Rathbun. Edgar Nathan. Gisela Piccolo.
Gisela Piccolo, right.
Lorna Brodkoff.
Yep.
Ted Davis. Richard Haskell. Jim and Harriet Morrill. Mm-hmm. And Rose Ann Needhammer.
Right.
Did I miss anybody?
I think you got them all.
Oh, good. Is there anything before we move on that you want to add about the Lake Wenanskapamic Association that I haven't asked you?
No, except that it wouldn't be Lakeville if you didn't have a good lake.
True.
And the lake is now in what we call a mesotrophic condition. There are three general classifications for lakes. Oligotrophic, which means they're like pristine.
You're going to have to spell those for me, but I'll call you on that.
Okay. Mesotrophic, they're in the middle. They're not great, but they're not awful. Mm-hmm. And endotrophic is like Lake Erie, dead. No fish. There's nothing living there, pretty much.
What was the first trophic?
Oligotrophic.
All right.
I don't even have those right here in the 1975 studies, so you can get there. But the key is to prevent eutrophication.
Right.
We don't want the lake to deteriorate any further. And so, as far as we can tell from all the studies we've mm-hmm. done since 1975, mm-hmm. The lake is staying at about that level.
Good. You're maintaining it then.
We're maintaining it at about that level. Now, the first part is that we sewered about half the lake. That's the east side, up Route 41 and around past Hotchkiss. Then we're on septic systems for the other half of the lake, the western part, and of course all up the Belgo Road watershed area.
Right.
And so that's, you know, and one of the things we do, of course, is every spring we send out a letter to every property owner in the whole watershed, mm-hmm. about 205 or so, 210 property owners, asking them to make sure that their septic tanks are pumped out on a regular basis, at least every 2 years, so that they're not going to spill phosphorus and other nutrients down into the lake.
That's a good reminder. It's a good reminder because people tend to forget.
Yeah, it is. I mean, unless you have them send you a postcard every 2 years.
Yeah.
I know Torrent does that. That's who I use. But I send out in the letter, I put the number for Torrent and Flood so that at least they have two people to call right off the bat. And there are some others you can call as well.
But it's good to have a reminder like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, and I think it works.
I'm sure it does.
The other, and we have discovered from the 1975 study that most of the nutrient loading in the lake comes from the watershed. And it was worse before the sewage project on the east side of the lake.
Oh, sure.
And we haven't been able to get the west side done because it's just phenomenally expensive.
I know.
And then there would be some resistance from property owners who already have a septic tank, but would then have to connect to the town's sewer system.
Yeah. Shall we move on to the Salisbury Forum?
Sure, sure.
All righty. When did the Salisbury Forum begin?
I should have brought Salisbury Forum material. I wasn't really prepared for that. That was about 1995. This is 2016 already.
You said it's been going about 10 years.
It's about 10 years, so it was either 2005 or 2006.
And whose idea was it?
Well, I think Frank DeChambeau was one of the founders. Claudia came downstairs here at the library, was one, and I'm not sure who else was in since I wasn't part of it at that time.
That's all right. The names are good.
The names are good. And the original idea was to provide a forum to bring in a speaker on a major issue, largely national issue, to generate discussion and bring a little information into the area that really wasn't available at that time.
So that we don't become isolated and provincial.
Yes, that's it. But you know the population of this area is really a pretty high level.
Oh yes.
You have the schools and the people who teach at the schools, and some of them retire here, probably many of them do. But you also have all the people from New York, some from Boston area, I suppose, who come up here as weekenders and come for the summer and then retire and stay here.
Well, this is one of the reasons why the Taconic Learning Center was started, mm-hmm. because people wanted college-level courses. They didn't want basket weaving.
Right.
They wanted meaty courses.
Meaty, yeah, that's.
And it's been as successful as the Salisbury Forum has been.
That's right. If you want intellectual meat, that's probably a good.
Well, you do. I mean, if you don't keep the brain active, you're going to lose it.
Yeah, very true. Yeah. Very true.
And you did say that at the beginning of the Salisbury Forum, there would be maybe three or four events.
There were. I think the first year there were four. Sander Van Oker, the former. Mm-hmm. NBC correspondent very prominent during the Kennedy years, was the first speaker on the media and politics. And then there were three other speakers that year. Dan Rather was one a year later. And we've had a number of professors from Yale, mm-hmm. for example, on issues of either constitutionality or foreign affairs and so forth.
And now you do more
now we,
of that.
Well, now we generally have six programs, three in the fall and three in the winter-spring. plus some films produced by high school students under the Civic Life Project.
We're going to get to that.
Okay.
You sent me a lot of material on the Salisbury Forum and the list of speakers and so forth, so I have that.
Oh, that's right. Yes, I did send you the list.
Oh, yes, and thank you so much. Is there a board for the Salisbury Forum?
Yes.
And how many are on?
I think 14.
And is there a term of office, or is it...
Yes, there we have a six-year term. Mine expires, actually, in 2017.
Oh, I'm glad I got you when I did.
I may have to... I just took over as treasurer this month, so I may have to stay on as voluntary treasurer or something.
Well, now, that brings us to how do you fund this? Is it, again, private?
Again, it's all by contributions. The forum events are all free and open to the public. But we pay for speakers, our expenses, travel expenses, lodging for speakers. And in some cases, the films we present, there are rights we have to buy, you know, that sort of thing.
Oh, sure.
But it's not terribly expensive. What is happening with the forum is that since the forum started 10 years ago, more of these kinds of events are being conducted by other organizations. The library has something going almost every Saturday afternoon.
Yes.
A lecture or something, a discussion.
The Salisbury Association does historical lectures, and the library does more of the literary things.
Right, exactly. And then the White Hart is having people now as almost all authors. So we are trying to bring in people that will draw a larger audience and maybe be people that you wouldn't get to a smaller event.
Right. Now, you told me that in September, the president of the American Collegiate Association is coming in.
Right.
And in October is Ann Garrels.
Right. And Adam Gopnik will be in December. Adam Gopnik is a writer for The New Yorker. He's done a number of subjects, spent quite a lot of time in France and Paris, and wrote on Paris and living in Paris.
Anything that you'd like to add about the Salisbury Forum?
Well, only that we're now trying to broaden our interest so that we're expanding away from kind of the foreign affairs, constitutional issues, events that we've had in the past. And we now have, for example, we have the Cuban poet who was the poet at the Obama second inaugural.
Oh, wonderful.
We had a lecture on architecture from the fellow who just wrote the Frank Gehry book. We had the woman who works for NASA, who is the chief electrical engineer on the Mars rover project.
Oh, wonderful.
And so she was really fascinating and brought some toys to show.
Oh, that's fun. You know, that's fun.
Graphics to show how, you know, the lunar rover, or the Mars rover, rather, works, and how they get information back. How they got it there was kind of interesting. To me, it boggles the imagination of anyone our age that they can send a rocket with a lander so far into space.
Yeah.
And then... and then get it to land successfully.
Yeah.
And during that landing period of about 14 minutes, there was no communication back to Earth. They had to just sit there with their fingers crossed, hoping that everything worked until the thing landed and could start transmitting back. And even then, it took another 15 minutes for the information to get back.
It's good engineering.
It's amazing. It's amazing what they do. Yeah.
Now, the Civic Life Project... How did you get involved in that one?
Well, it's through a friend who was involved.
You've got to be careful about your friends.
That's right, they're getting him into all kinds of things. But the Civic Life Project was started by two documentary film producers, a man and wife, Dominic Lesueur and Catherine Tottage. They live in Cornwall Bridge. And their idea was that if you get high school students to produce mini documentaries on a civic issue, then they have to learn something about their government and how it works. For example, this year, couple of the students at Hoosie wanted to do, why do so many convicts keep going back to prison? And they turned out a really interesting little documentary, that, partially by luck. They managed to locate a former convict mm-hmm. in Bridgeport who was with an organization that deals with former felons.
Right.
And he, when they went to interview him, he had rounded up two other guys. So they got the stories from all three of these guys about why they keep going back to prison. What was prison doing? Was it, you know, doing anything to try to reform them? And the answer was no. Mm-hmm. It was purely to hold them and punish them and so forth. And they also then talked to they got into this because one of the kids' fathers was at one time a prison guard. So he gave, you know, the opinion from the law enforcement side or the corrections officer side. So is that, but by having to go talk to these people then and talk to...
you learn.
They talked to somebody from the American Civil Liberties Union mm-hmm. About incarceration and so forth and to a state representative. So, you know, obviously... If you're going to go talk to a state representative at the Capitol, you're going to have some idea of what that is.
You do your homework.
Yes,
you do your homework.
And so that's what, you know, each of these kids, this year they did 17 films, and we showed five of them at the Salisbury Forum in June at the movie house in Millerton.
Do they have a faculty advisor?
Well, yes. Almost in all schools, they either have a faculty advisor or it's part of their regular civics or social studies courses.
Do you know who from the high school was advising?
Yes. It was Damon...
I don't know Damon.
Yeah, Damon Osora and John Lynch.
Who participates in this program? Is it volunteer? Do the students volunteer for this? Or
yes.
Is it an assignment?
Yeah, I think in all cases...
They volunteer.
Pretty sure in all cases that they can volunteer to be part of it. At the Magnet School in Hartford, Classical Magnet, it's part of what they call an enrichment course.
Yeah.
So it's an after-school activity primarily.
Is there a limit on how many students participate?
Not really. I mean, the first year that I worked with it, which was 5 years ago, we had one documentary being done at Hoosie, pretty much. One in Tarrington, one in Hartford.
And this year there were 17?
Well, this year there were five that actually got completed at Hoosie. Five or six, I'm trying to think. I have to think of all the titles. We had five at Classical Magnet. But now then there's festivals being developed also. So they're trying to expand this to a national program somehow, but just having these festivals, it also encourages the kids to do this, because if you're going to be shown somewhere outside of your classroom,
it's an independent study that's going to be
to a wider audience, but it also gives you a feeling that you're doing something important. In fact, mm-hmm. I even tell the kids when we first start, I said, look, this should be a lot of fun. And number one, when you do a paper for a history mm-hmm. class, you hand it in to the teacher and he files it and that's the end of it. In this case, you have a mini documentary that you can put in your resume and show it to your mm-hmm. college recruiter, and you can show it to other people. You can even, if you really are serious about this and want to go into this business, you can use it as part of your resume here's what I've already done, so you can see that I'm serious about this.
And this is why I try to get teenagers in the Oral History Project.
Yeah, probably.
Because they are now.
Yeah. good idea.
And I've done four on various things, and they've enjoyed it.
Yeah, good.
And they say, gee, you know, I'm part of history. And that's the point.
Yes.
That's the point.
Exactly.
Now, how is this project funded? Is it through the school?
Partially. The schools do contribute something. There's a state grant that they've been able to get. And they also, you know, seek contributions from either individuals or foundations and so forth. This is becoming a little sticky because as all budgets are being squeezed, particularly in the state, it's become a very big problem.
Oh, sure. Anything with the humanities, the arts, they're all getting squeezed.
Yeah, and it's a shame. In fact, Lynn Pascarella, the former Mount Holyoke president who is speaking for the forum in September, is speaking on the subject of the importance of a liberal arts education in the 21st century.
It is. It is important. Anything else you'd like to add to this section?
Well, I think that, you know, you've got it pretty well covered.
I try to. I try to, but I don't want to leave anything out because I don't have the expertise in this area that you do.
Well, anybody who's doing something, I suppose, you know, has their own expertise.
All right, we will go on to the Salisbury Dog Park.
Oh, the dog park.
Now, that's... Whose idea was that?
Well, that was Wendy Hamilton started the dog park a couple of years ago. And it's located over at Mary Peters Park, the entrance to Long Pond, off Long Pond Road. And it's about... 2 acres. The dog park is enclosed in a chain link fence, and it's split between a smaller area for small dogs and a larger area for bigger dogs. And in fact, there's a black screen along the divider between the two areas so that the big dogs and the small dogs
don't
get intimidated or intimidate each other. Wendy did quite a lot of homework to learn how a dog park should be built.
Yeah.
I've been to a couple of them, and this is by far
the
nicest one that I've seen. Yeah, and it's kept up very nicely because we have it mowed a couple of every 2 weeks.
So there's an oversight committee
Oh, yes. There's a board of about 7 people. And that's supported entirely by contributions. The land is owned by the town. It's part of this town park. Mm-hmm. So we didn't have to buy any property, but we do have to maintain it.
Do you have a dog?
Oh, yes. I have 2, Dudley and Buckley. Buckley is a 19-pound cockapoo, cocker spaniel, toy poodle. And Dudley Francis, no less, is Dudley Francis is a golden doodle, golden retriever, standard poodle mix.
Good heavens! And you have the mailbox that has the 2 dog pictures.
And that's the one.
Okay.
Can't miss it.
Again, anything that you want to add before we close?
No, I just hope people will use the dog park. It really is a nice little facility, and it's free. I mean, obviously, we're looking for contributions to keep it running.
How many clients are using it?
There's at least 30 or 40 now.
Oh, good.
You know, who come on a fairly regular basis. There's 2 reasons for going to the dog park. For some people, of course, if they live in a more congested area, the dogs can't run around. Besides being free and that they can, run and play, the other thing is they can engage with other dogs because socialization for dogs is very important.
Yes, it is.
And there are people who go there who also are pretty good at training dogs. So, you can. We have had and will have days of you know, dog training instruction.
Oh, wonderful!
So that you know, there's more than to the dog park than just going there to let your dog out.
Oh, sure. Do you have hours or days or?
Well, it's open from dawn to dusk, essentially.
And it's 7 days a week.
7 days a week. Somebody, I did it so far for 3 months, but somebody has to be the poop czar to go empty the
yeah
the trash bins a couple times a week.
Oh, this has been wonderful.
Well, good.
Thank you so much. I have enjoyed it. I've learned a lot, and that's the function of this.
Well, good. Pleasure talking to you. Thank you.
Thank you so much.